Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today we have the last installment of our full bio series, where we take a thick, detailed biography and break it down over the course of a week. We've been talking about the first full-length independent biography of Jimmy Carter, Jonathan Alter's new book, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. We began the week learning about a boy from Archery, Georgia, whose stern, disciplined, and bigoted father nicknamed him Hotshot. We learned about Carter's deep desire to be in the Navy and his penchant for writing steamy letters to the love of his life, Rosalynn. Carter was a one-term president whose independent ways made it possible for him to mediate a framework for peace in the Middle East, but also led him to miss all the signs that the embassy in Tehran was in danger of being overrun. Which brings us to Jimmy Carter's post-presidency. He changed what it meant to be a former president of the United States. He did not collect large speaking fees or book advances. He turned to philanthropy and good works, living his deep faith. He also did some freelance diplomatic work, much to the chagrin of the current occupants of the White House. Let's take a listen to the last of our conversations about his very best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. We know the obvious narratives for why Carter lost the presidency, Reagan's charisma and optimism, the narrative of good man, bad politician, the narrative of the Iran hostage crisis did him in. What is a reason that he lost that we can only understand now, 40 years later?
I think it's that American history is cyclical. And Jimmy Carter was kind of a speed bump on the transition from left to right that was going on in the 1970s and 80s. And so he sort of put a Band-Aid on the Democratic Party, right? And he was able to carry the South in 1976 because he was a Southerner. But by 1980... the transition of the South from Democratic to Republican was proceeding apace, and we were on this road to a post-New Deal world in American politics. And at that time, you know, we didn't really know it. I mean, we knew that the 1978 midterms had, had been shown that there was this conservative ascendancy in places like California with Proposition 13, which slashed property taxes in California. And there were other signs of evangelicals deserting Carter and being politicized and part of the conservative coalition. But we didn't really know that yet then, how important evangelicals would be to the American right, how much of a backlash there would be against the civil rights movement that would lead many Americans to become lifelong Republicans. And so there were these sort of tectonic plates of history that were shifting that we didn't really understand. And we thought in 1980, Carter lost because, you know, of the hostages and the bad economy and the fact that he was up against a great communicator. But there were larger forces at work.
Why does Jimmy Carter believe he lost the 1980 presidential election to Ronald Reagan?
Well, honestly, he has a kind of a facile answer. You know, he said to me, not for the first time to an interviewer, you know, if I'd had one more helicopter, mm-hmm. that Iran hostage rescue mission in April of 1980, when the helicopters crashed at Desert One, and, you know, if they had had one more, they could have then gone to Tehran and tried to free the hostages in a commando raid. First of all, I don't think that would have worked because the the mission was a kind of a Rube Goldberg contraption, and it's not at all clear that they would have gotten the hostages out alive. And second of all, even if he had gotten the hostages back, the economy was in such bad shape that I think he would have lost anyway. I actually think that Carter realizes that was a facile answer. And the reason I think that is I interviewed Paul Volcker not long before he died, and he told me a story about how in the 80s he went on a fishing trip, and both he and Carter were at this fishing lodge, and he went up to Carter and he said, I'm sorry if, you know, my decisions, by which he meant jacking up interest rates to, you know, 1.19%. Can you imagine running for re-election when interest rates are 19%? He said, I'm sorry if, you know, my decisions at the Fed cost you the presidency. And Carter smiled and said in a genuine way, Paul, there were many, many factors in my defeat.
There's a funny line about Carter being the only person to use the White House as a stepping stone, given how much work that he's done since the presidency. What were some of the things that he wanted to accomplish and has been able to accomplish that really would not have been possible in his position as president of the United States?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that he revolutionized three things. He revolutionized the role of vice president. Walter Mondale was given many more responsibilities than any of his predecessors, changed that permanently. He revolutionized the role of the first lady, and Rosalynn Carter was hugely influential. And then after leaving the White House, he revolutionized the post presidency. Before that, you know, you'd go on corporate boards, you'd give speeches, you'd play golf. And Carter felt like he wanted his library to be more than just, a place to collect his papers and have a museum. And in the middle of the night, he woke up a couple of years after he left the White House and said, you know, I'm going to build like a mini Camp David where we can have conferences and try to make peace. And it actually, it hasn't really been such a mini Camp David, although they've had a lot of conferences, but it's turned into this wonderful non-governmental organization. And they have been especially effective in three areas: global health, basically Guinea worm disease afflicted more than 3 million people a year, basically ruining their lives across many parts of Africa in particular. And now I think there are 30 cases worldwide, and that's as a result of the Carter Center. And then they've monitored elections in more than 100 countries and done important democracy promotion. He did have some big peacekeeping successes, especially in 1994, when he arguably prevented wars in Haiti and North Korea. So they have been very effective, and they have changed the expectations for what a former president can do. But having said that, he doesn't have any official power, and he doesn't have the levers of power that he had when he was president. And so this idea that, oh, he's gotten so much more accomplished as a former president than he did as president is just not factually true. And it's a sign of a kind of easy-minded assessment of Jimmy Carter that I'm trying to get beyond in my book. And I think that, one of the reasons I called the book His Very Best is that this determination, this persistence, this idea of never leaving anything on the field, basically never going on Miller time, even when he's in his 90s, that this is inspirational. And I think this is what is a model, not just for other presidents, but for all of us, that we can do better. And if we can get up every day, and we're not going to all be able to, you know, change the world the way Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter have, but we can all do a little bit more. And that's what Amy Carter told me, I think it was only the second interview she's ever granted. If you can believe it, she's 53 years old now. You know, that's what she said was her parents' greatest legacy, that we can all do a little more for other people, and you can advance yourself, and Carter was always ambitious, but also advance the lives of others, and that's a pretty good legacy to have.
Amy Carter borrowed my history book and never gave it back one day in college.
With Brown?
Yeah.
Well,
can I borrow that? Sure.
She didn't
got it back.
Finish. Yeah, she didn't finish Brown. She got very active in the anti-apartheid movement, and she was arrested a couple of times when she was at Brown.
I remember.
And she did not. She stopped going to class, and
I tried to get my book back.
Yeah, she ended up going to art school, and she now teaches art to elementary school students in Atlanta.
After reading this book, Jimmy Carter just seems like such a complex person, because on one hand, you know, he's waging peace, he's fighting disease, he's building hope, you know, but he's had all these problems in his own family, his children have many issues, substance abuse problems within the family. Some people think he was, as you said earlier this week, that he could be a real SOB. He could kind of be a little bit, look his nose down on people. He's taking the moral high ground. Yet he's done so much good in the world, and he really operated from a place of trying to do what he thought was right. What do you make of this split, this idea of just, maybe it isn't a split, maybe it's just he's a human and we need to think about him that way?
Well, that's it, Allison. I mean, look, you know, I agree with what Stephen Colbert says about Trump, that he's fundamentally boring. And by that, he means that there's nothing really to learn about him. We know who he is. And in some ways, he's entirely predictable. Jimmy Carter is the un-Trump, not just because he's a person of decency, honesty, accountability, integrity, but because he is enormously complicated. And there is a layered quality to him that I found fascinating when I was working on the book over the last 5 years, and that I hope readers find compelling. His aides, Zbigniew Brzezinski, once said that he had three smiles. He had the big one in public, which was sometimes, you know, a little bit artificial, put on to charm people and win votes and make peace, whatever he was after. Then he had a tight-lipped, angry smile in private, where he would glare at you with what his aides called the icy blues. And then beneath that would be a genuine, warm smile if he or somebody else got off a wry, amusing remark or something else amused him. So to me, that's just one frame on a really complicated and fascinating person who has led an epic American life.
Jimmy Carter is held in much higher esteem today than he was 30 years ago, certainly 40 years ago. What do you think changed?
Well, I think that the success of what he did as a former president eventually wore down people's in some cases, contempt for him. And he was stigmatized by the Republicans as a kind of, you know, a shorthand for failure. And they were pretty good at driving that message the way Democrats were with Herbert Hoover, another engineer, very intelligent engineer who was president. And the Democrats used Hoover as a punching bag for a long time. Republicans used Carter as a punching bag, but eventually his determination, his persistence, his ability to figure out new ways to save and change lives, it wore people down. And I think that, the consensus on him moved from respect for his integrity to admiration for his good deeds to what I think now is love. And as a younger generation sees him as a beloved figure. And I was really intrigued that Pete Buttigieg, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, they all made pilgrimages to Plains in 2020 seeking his blessing. And he said that he wanted a younger president. He's very happy, obviously, that Biden won, but he wanted somebody younger. And I've noticed that a lot of younger Americans are very interested in his career, especially in the age of Trump, that somebody can be good and do great things at the same time. And also the scope, the reach, the arc of his life is extraordinary, and I think beginning to be recognized as such. So I think of him as the only eminent American who effectively lived in three centuries. He was born in 1924, but it might as well have been the 19th century because they had no running water, no electricity, no mechanized farm equipment. And then, of course, he was president and involved in many of the great social movements of the 20th century. And as a former president, he's involved in democracy promotion, dispute resolution, global health, the cutting edge issues of the 21st century. So it's hard to think of anybody else who you could say that of. And I think if you live long enough, people come around to the right assessment of you. In the same way, it took Harry Truman about the same amount of time, about 30 or 40 years after he left office, before his contributions were more fully appreciated. And I think that revisionism of Carter is underway, and if I can be a small part of it, I'm really happy about that.
The name of the book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. Jonathan Alter, thank you for spending the week with us.
Thanks, Allison.